you know, each generation should do better than the previous one. We've both failed and succeeded on that level. We've succeeded in the sense that we've got more people who are challenging, you know, that are educated, that are challenging all the structures that they need to. But where we've failed is that people are still experiencing as many barriers and actually more so than I experienced, which is a significant failure, you know.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the lives, careers and victories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear stories, laughs and tears from some of the most interesting women across the state. This week, we learn about the incredible academic achievements of Dr. Tracy Westerman, from growing up in Useless Loop, and yes, that is a real place, I've checked, to developing four unique psychometric tests for Aboriginal youth mental health. Tracy has been a lifelong advocate for self-determination and advocacy in the mental health accessibility space for First Nations people everywhere. It's episode 8 of Herstory with 2018 inductee Dr. Tracy Westerman. This is Her Story.
Mum and Dad, Mavis and Mick Westerman, who two little scallywags, I guess, found each other. Both came from very disadvantaged backgrounds. Mum, obviously, as an Aboriginal woman, wasn't a citizen of her own country. So when Dad met Mum, she actually wasn't a citizen of Australia. And so Dad was a non-Aboriginal guy who, I guess, had a really rough upbringing to me, to put from his characterisation of it. And when they found each other, they basically were soulmates, essentially. Station people. Went out and worked on remote stations, and Mum worked as a shearer's cook. And back in the day, obviously, some listeners would be aware of the fact that Aboriginal people weren't paid, mm-hmm. so she wasn't paid a wage, so it was basically room and board. And when Dad married Mum, essentially he was treated as if he was a black person, which meant that he wasn't given the rights as he would have had as a non-Aboriginal person. He worked side by side with mostly Aboriginal people. And I think there was something in Dad that, because he was so disenfranchised from his family, there was something that really attracted him to disenfranchised people, I guess. And Aboriginal people took him under their wing and really protected him, looked after him. And so they're just completely by accident found each other, which was fantastic.
You speak about your parents with such admiration and clearly lots and lots of love and respect. Growing up, were they role models for you?
Yeah, definitely. Across lots of levels. I mean, they both didn't go past year three in education. So Mum, you know, it's not like I could come home and say, hey, help me with my schoolwork. So they weren't academic in the sense of being able to help you with schoolwork. But what they did actually represent to us is the strength of family. Family was everything. The other thing they actually represented to us was just hard work, you know, and they both were probably workaholics, to be quite frank.
Sure.
They worked and worked and worked and worked. So we had that as a model in front of us every day. But most importantly, their sense of right and wrong, their sense of morality and their sense of putting others before yourself was always something that was really taught to us from a young age.
It sounds like you had a really lovely and loving childhood, Tracy.
Yeah, definitely. And I think growing up in the bush, you get that. There is that thing where there's a freedom in how you're raised. And so I jokingly say we used to say goodbye on a Friday afternoon and come back on Sunday. And having five siblings, there's nothing better than that. You're never bored. And Mum wouldn't have it. She would not let us take a day off school. She would not let us get up past 6 a.m. If we were sitting on the couch, she'd say, what are you doing? Get out and explore. And so that was the thing. We were always taught to explore and be, and I guess think critically about everything.
Which bodes well for, I guess, the rest of your career, what you've made of it as well.
Yeah.
You were born in Carnarvon but moved to Tom Price in the mid-70s. Mm. What was that experience like moving so far?
It was really interesting. So we were mostly, the reason why I was born in Carnarvon, we didn't actually live in Carnarvon, we lived in a big metropolis called Useless Loop, which you can imagine gets lots of you. Get it out of the way, have a good laugh.
All right,
Everyone does
It's
that.
Just like, that's what you call, that's like a Schitt's Creek or something.
Oh, I know, it really is, and it really exists, and it's quite funny because I've sometimes tweeted stuff and gone, you know, I come from Useless Loop, and people are confused by that. And I go, no, it's actually a real place. And particularly when I do international keynote presentations and I say, you know, I was raised in Useless Loop, of course everyone bursts into laughter, and rightly so. So Useless Sleepers in the Murchison. And because we were quite remote, any time Mum was ready to give birth, Dad would literally get to the nearest location, which when I got to me, it was in Carnarvon. And okay. So we didn't live in Carnarvon. I was just born there. So that explains that. We then moved to Tom Price. Tom Price is an interesting place. It's we're the only Aboriginal family there back then. So mm-hmm. that was really interesting in the sense that it was our first house as well, like actual functioning house. So we had a floor and electricity and water and all these incredible things that people sort of take for granted. I was six, but yeah, first Aboriginal family in town. So we were always very conscious of that from the very get-go, that we were, I guess, different in a way, you know, to everyone else.
Different in a way, but also walks like and talks like a family is a family, right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
When did you first, I'm sure you're going to give us a very honest answer here, what was your first experience with racism like?
Horrible. It was probably my first recollection, because I do a lot of this in training, actually, really interestingly enough, getting people to come up with what their first actual recognition or memory of racism was. So for me, it was about seven, and I was in social studies class, and I remember being taught the actual social studies lesson was the teacher showed us the skull, a picture of Neanderthal man, and the skull of, it was Truganini, who was the last, it's a horrific story if people aren't aware of this, but the last, and I hate the term, full-blood Aboriginal from Tasmania who was actually beheaded and put in the museum. And Midnight Oil actually wrote a song about, it was called obviously Truganini, so showed the picture of the skull of Truganini, a picture of the skull of Neanderthal man, and was essentially saying that there's no difference, that we as Aboriginal people, we haven't evolved past Neanderthal man. And so I remember as a kid sitting in a classroom and straight away going, I don't want to be one of them.
Mm.
And it's a very common phase of identity formation, I've now known it as, that you actually reject, there is a sense of rejection of your culture. When you're around about below 8 years of age, there's a sense of rejection, and that's because you don't want to stand out for any perceived public negative reason. And so that's a really challenging thing for a young Aboriginal kid, to be the only black kid in a class.
Yeah. And I imagine that's the time as well where you're recognising that being an Aboriginal person is solely part of your identity, and then to have that on display in a classroom where it's other children being told, oh, look at this.
Yeah.
That's quite disheartening.
Yeah, it's actually more than that. I talk a lot about racism. Racism actually manifests in the same way as trauma, which doesn't really surprise me now when I look back at that early experience, and that's because trauma activates this thing called the flight or fight response, which means that you see threat and you perceive threat and your body gets ready to arm yourself to defend itself or to survive. And so I remember myself back then literally sitting in a classroom and the flight or fight response was actually activated by that. What if someone notices that I'm Aboriginal? What if someone says something racist? And so that's why it makes sense to me that they're now putting racism in the post-trauma sequelae, if you like, around mental ill health, because it makes a heap of sense to me.
It's a lot for a seven or an eight-year-old yeah. to have on their shoulders and to think about.
Yeah, and that's why we were raised. It's really interesting. We were, I think, as black kids, and particularly the way that people parent their kids is very different when you have a black kid. You have to fully be conscious of politics. You have to be conscious of activism because your human rights depend upon it. And so it's very different. My mum watches Parliament Question Time for sport, for fun.
Wow.
Because she knows, you point to a politician and she knows where they are and who they are, what portfolio they hold and all these things. And that's how we were raised. We were raised to be really politically aware and really conscious of our responsibility there in terms of educating others around, you know, Aboriginal issues and those sorts of things. So it does sound like a lot, but it's just your life.
Sure.
You know, it's not like you sit there and go, why was me? Why is this happening to me? It's a responsibility that we understood from a very young age.
And you've made an entire living out of it. Mm. In a slight sidestep, I was doing some reading and obviously a lot of research because you've done a lot of things in your life, Tracy. One of the things that I came across that I thought was just absolutely delightful, I'd love if you would retell us the story about the moment you realised your dad was a feminist.
I love this story, and it's funny putting labels on people. It's because he was just one of those people that there was nothing ambiguous about what he stood for. He always knew the difference between right and wrong. And so I was at university and, you know, amongst lots of other, you know, obviously females, it was actually St. Cat's, so it was all female college. And a lot of them would say things like, Dad, you know, can't see the point in me getting an education because I'm just going to get married and have kids. And I remember at that point just being so shocked by that. because here's my dad, who, you know, grew up on stations, you know, wasn't an educated man, was a smart man, wasn't an educated man in terms of a formal education, but he would say to me, you get out and get yourself an education. Every time I'd get an A or a good grade, I'd run home and show Dad. And so Dad always had this thing that you need to go out and be the best you possibly can at what you do, and don't allow anyone. I think there was actually a comment, a statement that he said to me was, you can be born into disadvantage, but never let that limit you nor define you. And he would just say things like that that just made so much sense, that gender was irrelevant. And he had four daughters, so he had no choice, really.
It was totally irrelevant at that point, yeah.
Yeah, and Mum, you know, being a very strong woman as well, I think that certainly helped it as well.
Tell us about what leads you to not just university but to studying psychology.
Goodness me, I just always wish I had a perfect answer for this, and I don't. I had to do School of the Air, and a lot of people are really shocked by that, you know. Mm-hmm. I had to do distance education to do most of my tertiary entrance subjects because I was the first one in Tom Price to do it.
Sure.
Everyone either worked in the mines or whatever.
And you want to do what, Tracy?
Yeah, exactly, and everyone's like, what? And it was really interesting. We had this Occupation Finder book that used to come out, and I went through it, and I just happened upon the description of a psychologist, and I thought, wow, that sounds all right. I think I might do that. I'd never met a psychologist in my life. I didn't know what they did, what they were. But I just knew that I could kind of work with people. And I always jokingly say, I think it's being the youngest of five and being constantly brought into, you know, breaking up arguments, or you being the, you know, the one that resolves conflicts and mediates and so forth. But yeah, it was one of those things that now I sort of think, as an Aboriginal person, our elders say that you were drawn to where you were supposed to be. And so I've had so many people over the years and years and years, when I go to remote communities in particular, whether it's Nunkery or Elders or whatever, actually say to me, you are so important to us, Tracy. You are doing what you need to do because you are meant to do it. You've been guided to do this. And so I think that's a better answer.
The universe has a really funny way, whether it be straightforward or roundabout, of making sure people are in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And clearly people, when you're back out on country, feel the same way as well.
Yeah. And I lucked out in terms of every single thing that I could possibly fathom in my career. I've never once regretted it. You know, I've found something that I'm technically pretty good at. I've found something that I absolutely love, to get out of bed and love it. I found something that makes a difference to people's lives, and I found something I can make a living out of. You've ticked every single box and then some when it comes to what I do every day. I'm so, so, so lucky.
You've hit the jackpot, mate.
I really have, yeah. Absolutely, 100%. Like, I just cannot believe. Yeah, I see people that, like, they find something they're good at, but they don't love it. You know, so you have those sorts of things that it doesn't cover off every single aspiration that you have for yourself. And there is that great saying, you find the thing you love and you'll never work a day in your life, is the thing, isn't it? And that's what I feel like every day.
I feel like I'm getting a self-help lesson right now. This is awesome. When you're at university, obviously you have to come and study in Perth.
Yeah.
What was that transition like?
Oh, so funny. I look back now and I'm so in awe of myself, to be quite honest, because I'd never caught a bus before. I'd never jumped in a lift. I'd never caught an escalator.
That would have been scary.
It was just overwhelming, but it was also like a smorgasbord of fun. So I was ready to leave Tom Price. I was, you know, nearly 18. Tom Price was great in terms of growing up there and the safety of it. But then going down to Perth, I was very, very, very ready to go. And so that was overwhelming in lots of ways. The university stuff was really overwhelming. I didn't cope at all with psychology for the first 3 years. It was not just the size of the university. I mean, you go in there and you've got 800 pairs of eyes staring back at you in the average lecture. And that's, you know, dwarfs the size of my hometown. So there's that bit. And then there's things like navigating a library. How do you do a bibliography? What's a bibliography? No one ever taught me that. I did distance education. I taught myself. And so those things were really challenging. And I guess I enjoyed the social side probably a bit too much.
It's been a running theme in this series.
That's right. When you're in Tom Price, you get sick of seeing the same people again and again and again. You go, there's more people outside of Tom Price. This is amazing. So off I went. And it was great fun like that. But it was the first time I questioned whether I'd made a right decision to study psychology, because we were basically invisible in the training, and that was really frustrating.
When you say we were invisible in the training, what do you mean?
Well, the word Aboriginal wasn't mentioned once in the first 3 years of my undergraduate qualification, and to me, when you've got the highest rates of suicide in Australia and the highest rates of trauma, child removal, incarceration, and the average psychologist is probably dealing with that on a daily basis, the training should match the statistics of what you're dealing with.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when people study these sorts of qualifications and these parts of education, they have the opposite impact, where they see too much of themselves in the syllabus, whereas you're sitting there having the complete opposite interaction.
In the wash-up of it all, it's made me, I'm starting to sound like I'm, you know, pumping my own horn here, but it's actually makes you a significantly better psychologist, because you can't take the teaching for granted. And I'd see a lot of non-Indigenous practitioners who'd go to lectures, their sole job was to learn everything off by heart, whereas my job was to rejig it and critique it and try to make it fit. And so the result of that is that from a perspective of critical thinking, you're having to critically think from the very start. And then, of course, when you go to remote communities, you're really geared up for that, you know, to basically not predict what's coming.
When did it become apparent to you that the mainstream psychology methods just weren't going to cut it for Indigenous mental health?
I think at a really practical level, I mean, bear in mind when I was not seeing the Indigenous stuff, I was an 18-year-old kid, so when you're 18 and you know everything, I want to go back to that age. So I really struggled, and then a great thing happened to me, and I applied for a job with welfare, community welfare, and they sent me out to the Central Desert, so Warburton, Warrakoona, Chikale, Blackstone. I look back again now and I think, what were you thinking? Like 21 years of age, you're basically going into the absolutely most complex of work environments you can possibly fathom. And it was a significant learning curve. It became obvious very quickly that the training just didn't match what I was seeing every single day.
So what do you do when you arrive there and you have this realisation that this is just not going to happen? What's the next step?
I think what you do is you actually then rely on your cultural instincts. And that was something that I had to unwire, if you like, because I was taught to think in a very mainstream way by my training. And then what I learnt ultimately was that people wanted to see me because they see an Aboriginal person. And so then what I had to do was just go, okay, here's a human here. Here's a human being here. And there's also the cultural side of me that was able to connect at that level of understanding, walk a mile in a black person's shoes. And I don't need you to explain to me what that feels like and thinks like, because I lived it. I've lived it. And so that became fundamental in terms of what I understood was the first step to healing, is that your pain is heard and validated. And so that was really easy. And then the next bit is understanding differences, whether it's differences in parenting, whether it's differences in how people engage or communicate. And then I just did a lot of testing out, you know, to see what actually worked. And then I became much more efficient at it over time.
You became so efficient at it that at the age of only 27, which that is so young.
It is so young.
And in 1998 as well, you founded the Indigenous Psychological Services, the IPS. All of these experiences in your early 20s have led to that moment.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I got long service leave, and I thought, okay, here's an opportunity. I think it was a $14,000 long service leave payment. And I thought, okay, this is, if I'm going to do it, I'll do it now, because I've got a little buffer to pay my mortgage. And if things go really badly, I can always go cap in hand back to the government. So I'll have a go at seeing whether I can start a private business. And it was literally, again, I look back on it now, and I think ignorance is sometimes bliss. You just do it because I had a mortgage, I had all these, you know, things, and, you know, it's really stressful to run a small business without that surety of a fortnightly wage. I was in the lounge room, front lounge of my house, and bought a fax machine, literally bought a $300 fax machine, and went through the list of all of the, you know, education department, all the, you know, places that I thought might be interested in being trained by me, and did up a flyer, and then just started faxing the flyer out for people to attend my trainings. And then nothing sort of happened for a little while.
Nobody replied?
Nobody replied. And then I went, okay, I've given that a go. And I had a couple little contracts here and there. And then all of a sudden it just went ballistic. And it's been going ballistic for 20 years now, non-stop.
So can you explain to us the Indigenous Psychological Services? It's where you provide training to other practitioners or the public?
Yeah, so we train the people who deliver the services, and it could be anywhere. The range of people that come are quite extraordinary. We have people from teachers through to police, through to psychologists, through to psychiatrists. We've had chief magistrates come. We've had lawyers come. So essentially, I think most people are dealing with people that are affected by mental ill health, and recognising really quickly that mainstream is not understanding it and enabling them to provide the best services possible. So I go all the way from sort of suicide prevention to trauma to depression to forensics, you know, there's child removal, attachment-based stuff. So it's an enormous amount of training that people get.
And all things that people who are practitioners and who provide services would have the mainstream knowledge about.
Yeah.
But having that cultural understanding is the absolute key.
Absolutely.
Why do you think there was initially maybe no faxes back to you quickly?
I think basically because you can't, some of it you can't be a prophet in your own land, right? So you're from WA, you're a kid from the bush, you know, what's she got
it's
to teach
perfect
us?
The person to do it, I say.
Exactly, what's she got to teach us? And so I had to, you know, you had to develop a brand. And that's the thing that I've learnt in business is that your brand is so critical because Perth's a very small town, WA is very small. The word of mouth is what actually creates a business. And that's what happened with me very quickly is that I don't think I was listed. I think I had a website for about 5 years, just through word of mouth.
Sure.
You know? Yeah, and that's great.
Coming up to 3 decades nearly since you started IPS, how's it changed from then till now?
I think I can do a lot more with a lot less. I used to do keynote presentations and I would spend days and days and days preparing. Now I turn up and I go, who am I speaking to today? You know, and I have 1,000 people in front of me. My workshops, I can literally talk for 4 days without referring to a note. But there were times when I would, you know, public speaking is the greatest fear. Number one fear is public speaking. Number two is death. Right? So people fear public speaking more than death.
The irony.
Which is the irony, yeah. And I can relate to that because my first couple of workshops, I would literally be not sleeping, almost feeling like I was going to vomit. And I tell my young students that now because they're quite surprised by that because I do so much public speaking. So I tell them that because I need them to understand that it takes a long time to get to that point of comfortableness. But, yeah, so it's probably that's a lot more with a lot less. And I've developed lots more products. I have obviously a lot more branding both nationally as well as internationally. So I find the business side of things to be much easier.
This entire undertaking has been self-funded.
Yeah.
Why was that such an important part of this for you?
I think it's because it gave me freedom. I think what happens is, yeah, absolutely it frustrated me because there was such a massive need and I knew ultimately that government funding enables you to get further out to those communities in need. However, it was important to me because despite the fact that we have unique aspects of why people become suicidal, why people end up incarcerated, there's obviously unique differences that Aboriginal people struggle with compared to non-Aboriginal, racism being an obvious one, identity being an obvious one. But we are a country that does not like difference. And so from the very start, I knew that we had to rebuild things from the ground up to see and test differences. Back when I started, and even still now, people just won't fund that. The starting point was that they wouldn't fund it. The second bit was because I was a private company, they wouldn't fund me. And so that was really challenging. And so then what I had to do was figure out a way to not just make money to pay the mortgage and pay the, you know, all the rest of it, but also ultimately I've always believed that it is our responsibility to give back. And that's always been the case. Even when I was in just making money to live on, I was still doing free work, free counselling, free assessment. And the reason why was because people were coming in, having seen a mainstream psychologist and not having a fundamental need met, which was to have assessment done correctly. Get assessment wrong, get treatment wrong, make things worse. And that's what a lot of our people are dealing with. It just became, I think, just through design. You know, it was just the reality of what I had to do. You know, I had no other option. And there were moments that was very frustrating. Yeah, it still is.
It was just the right thing to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you want to speak a little bit about what self-determination is?
Yeah, I think self-determination basically means exactly that we have, you can drop us in a room with anyone and we can more than hold our own. And that's basically been the case that I get contracts and I get work based on the expertise and skills that I have. And so what we don't need, what self-determination isn't, is when you say we want to be self-determining, but can you fund us government to be able to be self-determining? To me, that's not self-determining. That's still looking to government to actually fund you. And then what happens in government actually tell you how you should do it and when you should do it. And so I think in Australia, we haven't had that grassroots uprising of really exceptionally skilled. And that's not to suggest that people aren't skilled, but people who are able to compete with these big mainstream systems for funding and all the rest of it, because we just haven't had the access to education. We've only had it for, you know, 20, 30 years for some people.
By school of the air.
100%, yeah. And so we have many more barriers than non-Aboriginal people and 3% of the population. So when we actually are able to compete at an equal level, and we are getting there really quickly, then that's what self-determination provides us with, really.
This is a big question. I don't expect you to unpack it all and, you know, solve all the world's problems and we'll go home by 12 and have lunch, Tracy. But why...
Give me a go.
Why are people so hell-bent on making sure that there is still division? Whether they realise it or not, there's very much an othering that happens in Australia.
Yeah, there is. It's like when people say all lives matter. When you have Black Lives Matter, yeah, all lives do matter. And that's the aspiration. The aspiration is for not to have to say Black Lives Matter. The aspiration is for all lives to matter equally, but from any objective statistic, they clearly don't. So the heavy lifting has to be that people who come from privileged have a greater responsibility to do the heavy lifting from people who don't. So if you look at the reality, for example, of racism, or the reality of our suicide rates, or the reality of the incarceration rates, we can't fix that by ourselves because we are 3% of the population. We need white fellas marching in the streets with us. In the same way that you have, for example, you know, the sexual abuse stuff that's really rightly been amplified through Grace Tame and through the stuff that's happening in Parliament, women can't sort that by ourselves. We need men marching alongside us because the more voices say this is abhorrent to us, we need to do something about it, the greater the likelihood that politicians, because they respond to public pressure. And it was interesting, I heard Stan Grant, whom I'm an admirer of, but he has been on the record as saying that political marches or demonstrations really result in policy change. Yes, they do. If you have 70% of the population marching in the street or 80% of the population marching in the street, you know, the reality is it's very hard to get people to be concerned about something that only affects 3% of the population.
And let's not beat around the bush. I mean, the institutions are the ones that are keeping that distance.
Absolutely.
Still.
Yeah.
They need to jump ship.
Yeah, absolutely they do. And there is that thing. The greater responsibility of leadership is to talk to our most disadvantaged. And what people don't get, what we don't sell very well as people on the left and sort of, you know, socialist side, I guess, is that racism actually costs a lot of money. $45 billion a year racism costs. So, in fact, a more inclusive world is a more economically viable one in addition to being a better world to live in. You know?
You're looking for a surplus. It's right there.
Exactly right, yeah.
You completed a PhD. What year was that in?
So my PhD was completed in, and that did my head in at lots of levels, because here I am, a kid from the bush, you know, right? I was wrapped to just complete year 12. And all of a sudden, what am I doing, you know, being called Dr. Westerman? I actually made sure that Mum referred to me as Dr. Westerman ever since I got my...
She would have hated that.
Oh, no, she loved it. She thought it was just so funny. I said, no, it's not Tracy anymore, it's Dr. Westerman, thank you. She thinks it was very funny. But, you know, in her lifetime, here she is as an Aboriginal woman, not even a citizen of her own country, and in one generation has managed to raise a daughter with a PhD in clinical psychology. I mean, talk about close the gap in one generation, huh?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
And you're right, your mum having to prove her own citizenship in the 1960s, which seems, you know,
that's disgraceful.
Bonkers.
Yeah.
To sit there with a daughter who now is not only a PhD but holds both the PhD and a master's in clinical psychology, the first Aboriginal person to do so in WA.
Yeah.
What was the day like when you called your mum and you said, "All right, I've done it. This is the latest thing."
Your PhD is a bit like your child, and when's it finish? And I get warned about this from someone who'd done a PhD, and they said it's really hard to say it's done. I go, "What are you talking about? I can't get rid of this thing quick enough." And it literally was like that, because it's 3 years. It took me 3 years to do. 3.5 years to do master's and PhD. Most people spend 4 years just doing a PhD, and I did both in 3.5 years.
Okay.
Plus started a business, plus was renovating a house, plus doing all these things. So,
you bought a fax machine as well.
Yeah, I bought a fax machine. You know, I actually bought a really flash office chair as well, so that was pretty good. So it was, you know, it's beyond anything you ever imagined possible for yourself. And I actually have said this many times, that I'm one of those rare people that can actually hand on heart say I've exceeded every expectation I ever had for myself by a country mile.
Doing so in such style. Your PhD eventually led to the development of the Westerman Aboriginal Symptom Checklist for Youth, the WASCY.
Yep.
I don't think we've actually spoken to anybody in this entire series where they've actually had a thing, a practical tool or an application named after them. So you're the first, thank you.
Okay, that's all right, no worries.
Tell us about what that is.
Okay, so that was one of the outcomes of my PhD was to, you know, develop a unique, it was actually a world first at that stage and still is, a tool that was developed from the ground up by Aboriginal people for Aboriginal people, so that we can actually screen for early stages of suicide and mental health risk in Aboriginal youth. And the reason why it had never been done before is people tend to adapt mainstream tools. They don't develop something for a particular cultural group. And academics weren't happy about it. They didn't like the idea that we were developing a different test. It's really weird, hey? Again, we're a country that doesn't like difference. Because we have mainstream tests, whether it's an intelligence test, whether it's a test of depression, whether it's a test or whatever, because most of the stuff comes from mainstream research, they just want to keep using the same tools. And from a government perspective, they can then compare across populations. So this much depression in white non-Aboriginal people and this much depression in Aboriginal people. But if you have a different test, then they lose the possibility of comparing across populations. And so it comes down to something as basic as that, really.
Just to jump in, is it not just so ironic that the people who are supposed to look outside the box have a fascination with shoving everything in one box?
Yeah. Oh, no, definitely. There has to be a one-size-fits-all. I used to start becoming quite facetious with my, you know, keynote presentations. And I remember once in Melbourne, about 10 years ago, I got a standing ovation. It quite shocked me. And I went, you know what I love is when people adapt, say they've got a Indigenous-specific parenting program, and it's just a mainstream program with dot paintings on the front.
Oh, no. And people stand and clap.
They stand and clap. They standing ovation.
You failed the test.
Correct. And that's because you have to say things that I think people who do know me know that I am very direct in my messaging. It's probably a nice way of putting it, but I'm that's the Pilbara in me. I'm very direct in my messaging. I don't suffer fools, and I also say things that need to be said. And people are getting really frustrated by big organisations saying, look at this Indigenous-specific program we have, and it's actually not. Mm. It's just a mainstream program with a side order of cultural awareness, and that's just not good enough, and it's not respectful of the differences.
Can you explain that to us?
So cultural awareness would be basically give people knowledge and then we're going to let them off they go and they should be proficient in working at a real complex level around suicide, mental health, whatever. As you can appreciate, suicide looks different. How you engage with an Aboriginal person looks different. So what they should be doing is embedding content within all of your training that guides you from the very first start of engagement through to assessment, through the therapeutic intervention, which is what my content actually does. So we've had to test it and test it and test it so that it stands the benchmark of mainstream and they can't deny differences then. And so that's been a lot of work, a lot of research.
I imagine there's been a lot of naysayers as well. What are some of the barriers that you've come up against?
Oh, how many? Goodness me. I guess the first one was just the financial one was a big one. When I first brought the WASCE, the symptom checklist out, the first one was that people said, don't do it, just adapt an existing tool. So this idea of difference was something that people did not want to have. It's almost like once you open that, once you ring that bell, you can't unring it. So once you open up the possibility of difference, and a lot of psychology friends have now said to me, Tracy, you actually don't actually understand what you did. You actually challenged the core constructs of decades and decades of mainstream psychology research, and you said that, no, this actually doesn't work, but you did it in a way that was irrefutably evidence-based, that the data actually told you it was different. So there was that bit. And then I guess just the funding aspect of it. So the symptom checklist, when I first brought it out, I took out a $20,000 loan to print the manuals, to print the tests, all the rest of it. And then you had to basically, you know, get people accredited in it and get people prepared to purchase it to make the money back, and then, of course, put money back into research. So it's been lots of challenges. And then exhaustion, you know, like it's a lot of work delivering workshops and travelling around Australia, and it gets quite exhausting, just physically exhausting.
Well, you mentioned before growing up it was your responsibility to embrace your Aboriginal culture and to share that and educate people. But I imagine that also comes with quite a cost personally.
Oh, massive cost. And I think that's the thing, like I said earlier, that I can do a lot more with a lot less, but that's still not to suggest that there is a massive personal cost. And an example would be, you know, when I do write opinion pieces and they are, sometimes my family go, we just feel like we want to hide under the couch with some of the things. But it's always objective and it's always backed up with evidence, whether it's raise the age, whether it's the significant gaps in Indigenous suicide prevention, which are unacceptable, but I'm happy to call out. And the reason why I do that is because fundamentally the litmus test of progress is that each generation struggles less than the previous one. So my mum and dad did their job. They massively tick their box that we've struggled less than they did. So my responsibility is to take the hits, is to take, you know, all those things, the criticism, whatever is, I'm quite comfortable with that, so that the next generation doesn't have to.
Well, while you're taking those hits, Tracy, who have been the people around you and supporting you? I imagine your family are some of your absolute biggest cheerleaders.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and they're just extraordinary. You know, my sister says to me now, what award is she getting now? Like, what award is she winning this time? And so it is that. But I think most importantly, you know, my friends are 30-year friends and I have things like that. And they always say to me, you've never changed. I go, what do you expect? What do you expect? It's actually quite funny. And now they've given up saying you never change, because I used to say that all the time. And of course, in my Aboriginal community, I mean, what happens is they keep you grounded. You know, they keep you absolutely grounded. I'm still out in communities, and I'm still out doing the pulling their sleeves up and doing the hard yards and 40, 50 degrees. And that's what I've always chosen to continue to do, because you can understand what it's like to walk a mile in a black person's shoes, but what you don't want to do is forget what the journey feels like. And the minute you do that, the minute you do a great disservice to your own people and to the people you're working with.
You mentioned there about the next generation and wanting to, you know, lessen the suffering for the next generation. Yeah. And that happens through application of culturally appropriate psychological services. Mm. You've been pretty hands-on in training a lot of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people in that application. Yep. How is the next generation of psychology or psychologists looking? Is it something that you're excited about?
Yeah, I am, definitely. I'm an eternal optimist anyway, and I think when you're on the treatment side, you sort of have to be. I'm lucky I was a natural optimist. My dad was a natural optimist, so that's just luck. But when you're on the treatment side, you have to believe in the possibility of change. So I think anyone who's a psychologist ultimately is an optimist. But yeah, they are extraordinary. I think just the pure numbers, 40,000 people, I've personally trained 40,000 people, and that would be an underestimate. Mm-hmm. Now, that would put me as easily the, you know, most in-demand trainer in Australia. There'd be no one close to that, I'd imagine, in Australia. So that's the thing, that people are obviously reacting to it. What I'm finding over time is that people are much more less defensive about racism, about their own potential for racism. And I put people through, you know, experiential journeys around identifying unconscious bias and things like that. So it's pretty brave. You know, they come in pretty much stripped bare. So I do see that people are, and they're actually much more aware of the limitations of mainstream training as well. So there's lots of changes, yeah.
There's tens of thousands of psychologists in Australia at the moment, but still only a couple of hundred of them identify as Aboriginal people. How do we fix that gap? Like, where is the breakdown to getting Aboriginal people into the industry?
Yeah, I mean, look, the first thing is it's psychology is a really hard profession, hey, and that's what we really need to recognise, that it is Jesus, hard. It's really hard. And even to get into honours, you're not really employable as a psychologist until you do masters in clinical. So that's a 6-year commitment. And then to get into masters, you have to get an average of in the 70s. So it's actually, that's the first bit. It's pure science. It's statistics. It's actually really hard. So that's the first bit. And then the second thing, I guess, is that the first 4 years, we lose a lot of people because it is so scientifically laden. And I found that myself is, what are they teaching me this stuff for when I just want to go out and practice? Mm. And so psychology is called the scientist practitioner model. They teach you the science first, and then they teach you how to practice. But by the time you get to the practice bit, you've lost a lot of Aboriginal people, because we are very practical people. So there is that bit. And then the next bit is just the pure barriers that Aboriginal students face. It's just, it's extraordinary, the stuff that I faced, you know, as a student in a remote area, and all the barriers I had to burst through. That comment I made earlier about, you know, each generation should do better than the previous one, we've both failed and succeeded on that level. We've succeeded in the sense that we've got more people who are challenging, you know, that are educated, that are challenging all the structures that they need to. But where we've failed is that people are still experiencing as many barriers and actually more than I experienced, which is a significant failure, you know.
I just want to change pace for a moment and bring it into something that I'm sure you'll be excited to talk about. I'm excited to talk about.
Well, this is interesting.
It's all the awards and achievements. We actually don't have enough time to talk about them all because there are so many. It reads just like an entire movie script worth of achievements.
Yeah, right.
A couple of the highlights, though.
Okay.
In 2018, the WA recipient for the Australian of the Year Award.
Yep.
You were also recognised this year in the Queen's Birthday Honours List.
Yep.
The 2002 NAIDOC National Scholar of the Year, the Lifetime Achievement Award from Curtin University alumni in 2018. Telstra Business Women's Award, the 40 Under 40 WA Business Award, the 2006 Suicide Prevention Australia Award for Emerging Researcher. Take a breath.
Take a breath, yeah.
With each award, I mean, I imagine your family have just stopped coming at this point, but with each of these awards, is it one step closer to more people recognising the importance of the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I know the big one was obviously the Australian of the Year one, and I remember people started, like a bit like this exchange here, that people wanted to talk about, you know, about me. And I'm so used to talking about the work, and the work's always important. And I remember being really struggling with that. Then I went down and did a workshop in Albany, and the elders was did this beautiful welcome to country, and it brought me to tears. And they said, you know, Dr. Westman has shown us that by her example that anything is possible. And then I went, oh my God, this is actually not about me. And then I was good with it. You know, okay, this is actually about an Aboriginal kid from Roebourne picking up the paper and seeing my story and going, if she can do it, so can I. Mm. Because I didn't come from advantage. I didn't come from all these things. And so that was a real struggle. As a psychologist, we're taught to not self-disclose, not tell your personal, all that sort of stuff. And so for me, it is a major shift, actually, that when I, especially the Pilbara, when the Australian of the Year thing was on, Facebook literally went into meltdown, you know. And then when I went back there, it was like they rolled out the red dirt carpet, you know. It was extraordinary. But
it's amazing.
Yeah, and so the pride in people has been the thing that's been the most Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal. The one that really surprised me was the pride in non-Aboriginal people. That would stop me in the airports, and that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And that's been extraordinary.
It's the shared joy in the work.
Yeah, it really is. And I think the thing is, people, look, Australia likes an underdog, don't they?
You know, little Tracy from Useless Luke.
I hate saying it, you know, but they love an underdog, and they love the fact that, you know, you tick every single box, and yet that shouldn't have been a success and shouldn't have come out of Tom Price. Mm. And here you are, you know, having lots of world firsts in what you've achieved, which is fantastic.
One of the awards that I didn't mention there, but I do just want to touch on, yeah, is the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. You were inducted in 2018.
Yeah.
What was it like when you received that email?
Oh, it was good because it was on my birthday, so that's a nice nice little thing to have for my birthday. That's awesome. You know, there's certain things that, you know, that one there, the Women's Hall of Fame, and particularly, you know, with my beautiful friend Gina Williams AM, who's just extraordinary. It's really nice because I'm a real proud West Australian. Look, I'm such a proud Western Australian, and we live in a beautiful state. And that was such a recognition of just the body of work, and in a mainstream, I think it's really important that we get those mainstream recognitions, because essentially what's said there is that bring on all comers and you are the best that we can find in Western Australia, which is actually really cool.
It's just one of many layers to your identity as well,
yeah,
right? You're a woman,
yeah,
you're a West Australian, you're,
yeah,
an Aboriginal woman,
yep,
you're a shit-hot researcher.
And a marathon runner too, yeah. I've got to throw that in there.
Well, like, you know, look, we didn't quite get
to that
one. That's
what I'm most proud
of. I mean, that's a whole different sort of mental preparation,
there's
right?
There's nothing normal about it, no. I fully accept that there's nothing
Your word's
normal.
Not mine.
Correct.
Tracy, how do you want to be remembered?
Oh, look, I think I want to be remembered as someone who cared, you know, who despite it all, despite, you know, all the barriers that you sort of come through, that ultimately the most important thing you can do is to care, and the most important thing you can do is give everything your best go every single minute of every day. And that's probably the most important thing, yeah.
The name of this podcast series is Her Story. Have you come across that term before?
Her story.
Yeah, Herstory, yeah. History.
No, I haven't actually.
Thoughts about it?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's great. It's a nice little, Brangelina or something like that.
Yeah.
Putting these, you know, two terms together, or, you know.
Just like Brangelina.
Exactly.
They're not coming on the podcast, by the way. Don't get excited if you're listening. So we are a radio station predominantly, and when this does air on the radio, we will play some music to accompany our conversation. I have,
yeah,
a feeling I already know what you're going to say, but do you have a favourite musician or artist or song that you want to hear?
Oh, this is terrible because we grew up with so much music, and you know what? We grew up with two types of music, country and Western.
Mm-hmm.
Either one is fine. I can identify so many different, you know, Alan Jackson's or whatever, but my beautiful father passed away in 1996, and at his funeral, now you're going to really struggle to find this.
I'll go digging.
I might have to help you with it. It's a Slim Dusty song.
Okay.
And it's called When the Golden Slip Rails Are Down. We played that at Dad's funeral, and it represented him, you know, so well. So I think if I had to choose a song, it would probably be that one. The other one is going to be really more difficult to play. Mum and Dad, every single major event would dance to this, and it's called Mum and Dad's Waltz by Lefty Frizzell.
Oh, okay.
Now, that one would bring tears to your eyes because it's very much about this beautiful love story between, you know, your mum and dad, and they danced. Mm. And when Dad passed away, my brother stepped in and danced to this song with, and literally grown men were crying.
Oh, so you're going to make me cry now.
And it is it's an absolute, like, it's a really old song.
Yeah.
But it's just, I'd walk for miles, cry a smile for my mama and daddy, aren't you? And it's like that. It's just really beautiful song about two people that just found each other, and it's just perfect for those two.
I'm definitely going digging for that one now. I'm also going to play some Gina Williams because you just mentioned
her.
Oh,
yes, of course. I can't. My sister Gina, she just doesn't need a surname. She's just Gina. She's like Madonna,
like Kylie.
Or Kylie or whatever. Yeah, she's definitely a national treasure, that lady. She's just awesome. And it's hard because we've got the beautiful John Butler who played at our concert recently, and, you know, so many amazing songs to pick from. But if I had to go, you know, what represents our family and what represents the journey, it would be, you know, the Slim Dusty song or Lefty Frizzell easily.
All right, well, I'm going to find both of those. Tracy, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. That was awesome. That was lots of fun.
Thanks to Dr. Tracy Westerman and all the women at the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make this podcast happen. Our executive producer and editor is Danae Gibson. Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomaeus and Sophie Minisale are the assistant producers. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the WA Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for episode 9. Hey there, if you'd like some more information, Dr. Tracy Westerman actually recommended a few different resources to us. You can start by searching online for the Australian Indigenous Psychologists Association, or of course, Lifeline's number is 13 11 14.